Welcome to Alaska Edition, a weekly public affairs program produced by Alaska Public Media in the studios of KAKM. The host and moderator for Alaska Edition is Lori Townsend.
Hello, thanks for joining us today. My guest today is Mark Trahant. Mark is the UAA Atwood Chair of Journalism, University of Alaska Anchorage, I should say. We're going to be discussing diversity in newsrooms and how that changes the way stories are told. Mark, thanks for joining me today in the studio. Give us a bit of background on your work and how that led up to your current job at UAA. You're the first Native person to hold the Atwood Chair position.
I've been remarkably lucky for some 30 years. I started basically as a teenager editing my tribal newspaper, the Chauvin News in Fort Hall, Idaho. And from there, worked primarily in the tribal press for a number of years, the Chauvin News and the Navajo Times, and for a brief period in Washington at the Department of Interior. And then I kind of went on a more traditional path for journalism at any rate. I went to the Salt Lake Tribune where I was an editor, and they sent me to Moscow, Idaho as a publisher. And then I went to the Seattle Times as a columnist, and eventually ended up kind of in my last traditional job at the Seattle Post-Intelligencer, where I was the editor of the editorial page. The past 5 years, I've been kind of doing social media. I had a fellowship from the Kaiser Family Foundation and focused on healthcare reform right as the whole thing was unfolding. And really been just remarkably lucky and had an extraordinary ride.
Well, we'll talk some about the Affordable Care Act and Native communities, but you worked on a frontline program called The Silence. Tell us how that project came to be and your involvement in Alaska with that program.
Well, this The Silence really came out of the blue. I was in Albuquerque working on healthcare reform reporting and received a call from the executive producer of Frontline, David Fanning, at the time. And he proposed this film and basically said it's underway, but they need some a journalist to be involved. And my first thought was I didn't want to touch it. The subject was intense. Mm. I was in the middle of other things. But it didn't take me long thinking it through to get involved. And it was really glad I did, because I just met so many remarkable people across the state of Alaska, but particularly in St. Michael's. And it was one of those stories that was life-changing, and you're thinking, wow, I'm really privileged to be a part of this.
Do you think that your ethnicity, Shoshone Bannock tribal member, did that play a role in your work on the documentary?
Well, I think you bring a little bit of who you are into every story, so in that sense, yes, but in the broader sense, no, because I wasn't raised in a community that was that isolated. And I think that was a big part of the abuse factor. So yes and no, I guess would be the short answer.
You have said that Native people have not only a right, but an obligation to tell their stories. What do you mean by that? Are you talking about journalism, or what type of stories?
Well, and this is kind of a weird way of answering it, but there was a remarkable approach to journalism in 1947. Where the university scholar Robert Maynard Hutchins brought together a number of people to talk about how journalism fits into a democracy. And one of the things that the Hutchins Commission focused on was that a working democracy, absent all the voices, won't survive. And I think you're seeing that across the world played out in many, many cases, where in order for people to have a working knowledge to be able to make decisions in a democracy, they have to hear from everybody. And one of the problems with a small group of people, such as American Indians and Alaska Natives, is it's so easy to take a sample group action and distort it. And to have that full reflection, you really need to have people from the community who can tell the stories in the complexity, rather than just a message that can be taken into a caricature.
One of the things, as you mentioned your Kaiser Foundation work, and one of the focuses, as I understand it, during your time here in Alaska will be on getting the word out about the Affordable Care Act to Native communities. How do you think that is done most effectively? Is it through traditional press, or are there other ways that Native communities want to take in that information and trust it?
Oh, there are a lot of ways now. I'm working on a series of very short films about the Affordable Care Act, 5 minutes in nature, in length rather. And probably the primary vehicle will be social media, Facebook and Twitter. And you can distribute. You think about all of the obstacles that people had just a decade ago to getting the word out, and they vanished because of social media. Somebody with a good, compelling story can find an audience. And I think that's really an important opportunity.
Well, as you well know, there's a complicated past in Native communities with the press. And there's at times been a lot of misinformation. Sometimes it seemed purposeful. At other times, I think it's just an error. And an example is the other day I saw a photo in the New York Times, I think it was, of a young Yemeni woman with a traditional regalia on, and the caption was "a Yemeni girl in traditional costume." And those kind of mistakes most people wouldn't understand or recognize, but as you know, that's offensive. Talk a little bit about how that sort of, just those small words can really change the way that somebody takes in a message or believes what the press is saying.
Sure. Well, one of the, I guess, complexities is that minority groups in general, but let's focus on American Indians and Alaska Natives, are somehow supposed to be relegated to another time period rather than to be modern players in a modern democracy. And nobody, for example, would go up to an American and say, "You don't dress like Abe Lincoln, so therefore you're not American." That time period is just not locked in. Yet that often is the case, both in image and words involving Indian people, Native people. I think part of it is the ability. I mean, so much of the country's history is taught in school as city, county, state, and federal. And so kids grow up with this very strict interpretation of government through the education system. And then they get to be adults and they start reading the media or watching television, and they start reading about complexities involving tribal governments. They weren't part of the education system. So the media then gets the responsibility of educating about a complex system rather than the educational system. Some states have actually taken some really interesting approaches to that. The one that's most exciting is Montana, where they call it Indian Education for All. And basically, to get through the school system in Montana, you have to have a basic understanding of how tribes fit into the system. And so it's not all burden of the media, but broader society.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that there's times that it makes sense, there's a responsibility, as you said, for Native people to tell their stories, but are there times when it makes sense to have a non-Native person report on issues in Native communities? I have my own examples from my history and past working in tribal media, but I'd like to hear your thoughts on that.
Oh, I'd just say it's both. I mean, there's so many stories that remain untold, and the more people telling those stories is better. And I think having different points of view is very helpful to the process as well. The problem is, if you look at two centuries of stories, it's so small that Native people have gotten to tell their own stories, that's where the gap needs to be, the velocity of those stories needs to be increased somewhat.
Mm-hmm. Is there a different set of expectations in particularly in Native communities, or maybe in the broader society, on your reporting? Is there an expectation that you will take a certain perspective or perhaps be more sympathetic to the Native side of issues because of your heritage?
Sure. Well, one of the big differences is somebody covering, say, the Alaska state government, which is only a half century old, doesn't then have to explain to their readers, both residents of Alaska and beyond, that the state of Alaska has a right to exist. Yet the Native reporter with governments that have been around a lot longer than that has to carry around that burden of saying these governments have a right to exist, and they're constitutionally based, and they have a history and a purpose.
Mm-hmm. Can you be an impartial journalist and report on Native issues?
Well, I don't believe in impartial journalism anyway. I believe in fair journalism. And I think everyone brings something to a story, and it's the burden then to go through and make sure you're being fair to everybody involved. One of the challenges for journalism students, and I kind of preach this all the time in my courses, is to read things that you disagree with and then try to think about what people are trying to say in that material and to really absorb it and not just get sucked into only listening to people that say what you say.
Mm-hmm. While you're in Alaska, you'll spend time in rural communities. I think that's part of your mandate as the UA Atwood Chair. Are you hoping to recruit more Alaska Native people into journalism?
Oh, I'd love to see that, and I'd love to talk to as many young people about the... This is a really exciting time for journalism, and I know so much of the discourse has been about how institutions are changing in some really scary ways, and that's all true, but at the same time, because of social media and because of new avenues of distribution, there are tremendous opportunities to people with imaginations. And I think somebody in a rural village now could practice journalism and support themselves and never have to move. And that's something that didn't exist when I was a kid. So I think this is a great time for people to get interested in telling stories and looking for ways to distribute that. You think about the power of YouTube, for example, and somebody could produce stories from a community like Hayward, Wisconsin, and have it be all over the world every single day. I mean, that's just remarkable.
How has that changed in the time that you've been a reporter as far as Native people going into journalism? Are you seeing less, more? How would you gauge that?
Oh, by far more. When I was president of the Native American Journalists Association back in the early 80s, and at that time I was probably one of a handful working in mainstream press, and by the time I had stepped down as president of NAJA, most of the members were working in mainstream press rather than the tribal medium. So I think that is pretty. And you go to the conventions now, and there's just young people working all over the place. One of my favorite is a young man by the name of Dalton Walker, who just became the social media editor for the Colorado Springs Gazette. Great story.
Mm-hmm. National Native News at one time had a kind of a promotional line that said, if our microphones had been there, history would have been recorded differently. Howard Rock here in Alaska developed the Tundra Times out of a newsletter, initially sort of just coalescing people in these remote communities so that they had some common communications. And it raised attention about the proposal for Project Chariot and then moved on to information about the land claim settlement, the Alaska Native Land Claims Act. What do you think would have been different if there had been more Native people in reporting 40 years ago when this was happening? Do you think that there might be different rules for disclosure with tribal governments than there are now? Or how do you think that may have changed the dynamic about how these claims came together, or would it have changed it?
Well, I think the Native press with the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act was extraordinarily involved in ways that are kind of forgotten to history. One, for example, is not only Howard Rock here, well, in Fairbanks, but Tom Richards Jr. was covering day by day the events as they unfolded in Washington, D.C., and not just for Alaska Native readers, but for Indian country. He was writing for the American Indian Press Association, which at that time was kind of an Indian version of AP. And so the whole country watched the story unfold as it happened in real time, a week at a time rather than instant like we have today. But that was really one of the first stories where that happened in a real, ongoing, methodical way. The story was covered by Indian country as it was unfolding. And I think that did help shape the bill in a lot of ways, not just Howard Rock's role here, but in the larger sense, particularly in Washington. In fact, if you go back and read some of the stuff that Richards wrote, it was prescient. I mean, he was talking about some of the holes in the law, both with subsistence and things that were left unsettled by ANCSA back almost 50 years ago.
Do you have concerns generally about what disclosure rules are in place for tribal governments. They are governments, and they have a relationship with the federal government, but there are not the same rules in place for tribal governments as far as disclosing to the public about their financial records as there are in state government settings. Is that concerning?
Well, it is, and this is how I look at it. In fact, it's funny because I spoke at the National Congress of American Indians a couple of years ago and outlined transparency as one of the areas that I think tribes had to work on. And the way I kind of framed it is that transparency is a new currency. And the more that tribes are open and allow people to go through the material, the more they're going to have kind of a strength against this onslaught of austerity. The flip side of that, and one that makes it extraordinarily complicated, is that tribes are also businesses, particularly in the lower 48. And so they have information that is kind of corporate, competitive, of a competitive nature, such as land holdings and resource extraction areas, that sort of thing. So it kind of makes it a bit more complex. That said, I think really it's important. Social media is changing that in ways that are both good and bad. One of the ways that it's good is that more tribes are using social media to release information directly to both membership and to the broader community. And that's important because, again, in many cases, some of the larger tribes are also large employers. So their membership is not the only constituency, but people who work for them or avail from their services are a constituency as well. And so that transparency is really critical there. The downside is that you've seen the kind of the flip side. There was a number of settlements last year involving land claims that were kind of long-standing or legal claims that were long-standing. And a lot of tribal governments were under tremendous pressure because of social media to distribute those monies directly to members rather than to have the tribe take it in as a government would and kind of spend it as a government would. And I think that's kind of the flip side of transparency. It allows a wave of interest that may or may not be in the long-term interest of a tribe.
Mm-hmm. Why are ethnic newspapers important, ethnic press? Why do we need news from Indian country? Why can't local papers just handle these stories?
Well, probably they could if they would. That's part of the problem. And particularly as newspapers have gone through this retrenchment period, they've actually cut back in areas like that. And so it's made it more difficult to get that kind of story out. I think tribal newspapers tend to be community newspapers. One of the ways I used to look at it as an editor is what's the kind of stuff that parents clip out and stick on the refrigerator? And that's stuff that your child does really well in school and that's in the paper. There's maybe a sporting event and your child does well and that's in the paper. Could be an obituary, sadly. Those are the kind of things that really connect with people. And once they're on that refrigerator, they're looked at not just in the daily context, but every day as you walk by, as you get milk, whatever. And that, to me, is the real mark of when a paper is involved with a community, is when it has lots of things that can be clipped out and stuck up on the refrigerator.
What are some of the reporting projects that you hope to undertake while you're here at UAA?
I really am going to let students do as much of that as possible and kind of work with them. Second semester, I'll be teaching both investigative journalism and multimedia journalism. So those classes will be project focused. And as the students come up with ideas, we'll help shape those and say, here are some things you might think about and kind of go with that. Personally, I also want to spend, I've been working on a book for a couple of years now on austerity. And I want to try to finish that while I'm up here. So much of our discourse about how the federal government spends money is about programs. And what I'd like to do is pull back and look at demographics. And we have, like many Western countries, an aging of the population that changes everything. And how an older generation deals with a younger population and the tension between the two on what programs matter, I think is really important. For example, throughout this latest budget back and forth, there's been a lot of cutting of domestic discretionary programs but virtually none of the entitlement programs such as Social Security. And that's a legitimate choice. But what it means is that we're not investing in young people with education and some of the other programs that might help pay that Social Security down the road. And so that's the kind of things I'd like to address in a book.
And how does that fit within the context of your work as a tribal person, as someone who is looking at this from not only a national perspective, but also a tribal perspective? How do those two kind of segue together?
Well, and to me, it's what it takes to have your community remain strong, and good, solid information is one way that happens. So, fortunately, I've never been inclined to be a politician, but if politicians could have good information, maybe it would help them make better decisions. So my role is to try to be out there and to provide information. And I do that in some really unusual ways. One of my latest projects, for example, is a page on Facebook where I just post things that I'm interested in and columns that I'm interested in and columns that I write. And there's a group of folks out there that tune into that on a regular basis.
Mm-hmm. Mark, you had to become adept at being a freelancer, an independent journalist, after the Seattle Post Intelligencer went away. How has that changed your work? And what do you tell the students that you have now about what they'll have to, what they're going to need to do to be in the field of contemporary journalism?
Well, I think there still are opportunities in traditional media. They're just going to be fewer and different. But I think where there's a real growth area is for people who can put together great projects and then go out and sell those projects. And for an independent journalist, that means you're going to have to be thinking about the project you're working on, the project you want to sell, and the project you want to sell after that. So it requires more juggling, and it's a different way of looking at things. But I think that's kind of how the economy is going for a lot of people anyway, that it's not going to be the traditional job. And in a really curious way, the Affordable Care Act makes that easier, because one of the big barriers to people operating independently has been health insurance, where I've gone through COBRA a couple of times, and it's huge price tag, but the ability to have that be taken off your plate so that you don't have to worry about it, I think is going to make it a lot more opportunity for really small one-person operations. And it's not just in journalism. There's, demographers call it the lone wolf business, where people are being consultants and finding new ways to get out and sell themselves.
We're sort of in the midst of this big social experiment right now with the advent of so much immediacy in the online presentation of information. And we're at a time when there's more coming at us than ever before, and it's easier to access a wide range of information than ever before, yet there's also a tremendous amount of misinformation out there. What are you hearing from students about how they discern what they're looking at? Because I know I have great concerns about, are young people really able to understand what they're looking at online and make sure that they're looking at properly sourced and solid journalism rather mm-hmm. than things that sort of look like journalism. They have a dateline, but they aren't.
Well, and that's going to be the challenge, is to come up with a way, not just for journalists, but for citizens, to test information so that it's not that just you're a passive consumer of it, but you're someone who takes that information and then somehow tests it. That said, the way we get information is just going to be different, and it's something that we've got to think about differently. And I think a good example of that is The Daily Show. The Daily Show conveys an awful lot of really important information and distills it in a way that's attractive to people. And I saw one study about how well-informed people are that watch that show regularly because of that, compared to people who don't. So
that's a bit frightening.
it is and it isn't. I mean, it is because, let's take some of the subject areas. The Daily Show wanders into international news almost every day. Most of our newscasts on the main networks kind of touch it, but not nearly as often and nearly as deep. So yes and no. I mean, there's trade-offs.
Mm-hmm. What communities do you know that you'll be visiting while you're here in state?
Well, Well, I'm hoping to go to Bethel. I've got some reasons to go there. I've been there before to do some reporting on the dental health therapist program, and I'd kind of like to follow up and see how it's going kind of after a couple of years. Beyond that, I'm not sure yet. It's still kind of fluid.
But hopefully some villages you'll get
Absolutely.
Out to see some of rural Alaska.
Right. I'd love to go back to St. Michael's as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, are there specific things, we're just about out of time, but are there specific things that you plan to do with students in rural Alaska? Will you be taking students with you, or will you be traveling alone?
I think at some point we probably will, but that still has
to be worked out.
Worked out, yes.
All right. Well, thank you, Mark, for being on with me today. We'll bring you back at some point in time and have a wider discussion about diversity in the newsroom. It's great to have you here and in Alaska, so thanks for joining me. Michael Carey will be back with you next week, and I'm pleased that you joined us today. Thanks for tuning in.
If you have questions or comments about the program, you can email Alaska Edition at alaskapublic.org or write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508. Alaska Edition is a production of KAKM. The opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests and do not necessarily represent those of KSKA, KAKM, the licensee, or their underwriters.